Down to Business with Bobby Kerr.
Brought to you by Bank of Ireland
on News Talk.
We'll have a look at the business stories of the week and indeed the weekend. Delighted to be joined by broadcaster, former colleague and businesswoman Nora Casey, and also by John Isle, the deputy to business editor with the Sunday Times. Good morning, one and all. What wonderful weather we're having.
That's wonderful.
Yes, and thank you for coming in this morning. John, we might start with you. Cliff Taylor has a kind of a narrative there, which covers quite a lot of topics, but he really says that Ireland needs to ditch empty promises and economic fairy tales and start confronting reality. An awful lot in this piece.
Yeah, well, he's pointing out that there's a huge volume of plans coming through this summer. And it's happening at a very unstable time, obviously, in terms of international trade and economic relations. But he just catalogs them here and he says, we're due an updated housing plan, a new strategy on competitiveness and productivity, the summer economic statement, and a new medium-term budget strategy, along with the revised national development plan outlining what the state is going to invest in. And what he's saying is, if you look back at previous plans, previous strategies, etc., that we have to conclude that basically the government, whichever government of the day, they've been gaslighting us for decades. There hasn't been a believable strategy. Implementation has been poor. Delivery has either been late or non-existent. And you have a situation where successive governments are endlessly deferring needed investment and then also not sticking to the own targets that they set out for themselves. And there hasn't been a lot of accountability for this. Primarily, I think, because of the massive influx of passive income from corporate tax that is really papering over a lot of these cracks. So he's saying we don't have the luxury anymore of living on this. We're on borrowed time at the moment. Things are moving quickly and things are moving out of our control. So the best thing to do is get our own story straight, do the things we set out to do, and then we can deal with whatever happens in the rest of the world on our own terms.
Nora, one of the things that Cliff Taylor tells us is that government spending has risen by 37% since 2021. Had the annual spending limits of 5% set by the previous administration been adhered to, the increase would have been 16%. That's a 16 billion euro difference.
It's staggering. In fairness, if you take the, you can see the frustration in Cliff, and you know it's a great read, but you can see he targets things like, you can't just write new documents because they're all fairy tales. You have to actually write something coherent. You need to take into account the fact that you've lost confidence in the country. Big projects like the metro, people don't believe it's going to happen. The children's hospital, the leaks about waste within government departments, the bike shed outside Leinster House, all these things he's thrown into this pot of a mess. But if you pull yourself back from that, in 2000, when I moved back to Ireland, there was 3.6 million people here in the Republic of Ireland. And that's now up to nearly 5.6.
So we
are overall a successful country that's done a huge amount right. We do have a surplus. We're in positive on our trade balance. We've got virtually full employment. Inflation is going down. Wages are set to increase. But this one thing that we just have never got right is housing. And when you see the long list of reasons as to why, issues around planning control, about investment, about the construction industry sitting on its hands waiting for new incentives to come to the fore, we're simply not keeping up with this, what essentially is a fast-moving open economy that has lots more people, lots of employment, and we just don't have anywhere for them to live.
John, you mentioned it earlier, but there's a lot going on here. And, you know, some of the things are, we've got this drip feed then of information, into this pot that Nora referenced there, which is causing further, I think, dismay and confusion and a bit of uncertainty. But I think, you know, what Cliff Taylor does underwrite his article by saying that we're in a good position, we're in a better position than most European countries, and let's not screw it up.
Well, that's true, and if you look at, say, Germany, which has realized that they have a big infrastructure deficit there, they're going to increase massively their defense spending. They're having to do it in a way that is causing a lot of political anguish for them, which is they have to go out into the markets and borrow. They don't have the resources internally from their own tax base to make the investments that they need. We're in the fortunate position of throwing off this massive surplus that we can put into future funds that we can draw down as needed. But the point Cliff is making also, and Nora has touched on this, is that the population and the economy has actually grown so fast that there's, strangely, despite all the spending, still this deficit, this infrastructure deficit. And part of that is caused by the kind of the red tape, but also the hesitation and the endless deferral that the government has in implementing plans because they see something risky happening over there. Oh, it's the tariffs. It's the war in Ukraine. It's COVID. It's whatever. And I think what the best point Cliff makes in this, I think, is we've got to write our own story here. We can't just wait for things to calm down internationally before we make decisions on things we already know the country needs. We just have to go ahead and do it and deal with the problems as they arise.
Yeah, so it's more about doing than strategizing and writing reports and all that good stuff. Nora, you mentioned it there earlier about the housing, the decline in home building activity, a disappointing start to the year. Home building slumping by 10.6% in the first quarter compared to last year. This is very disappointing. It also causes a big problem for the government because in some cases, this is the only show in town. Yeah. If they can't get this right, they're going to be really on the ropes on so many other issues.
It's a very good companion piece, actually, to Cliff Taylor's piece because it really, you know, focuses the mind on the fact that we're just barely 6 months into this government and a lot of the promises that were made just aren't being kept and aren't going to be kept because, as you pointed out, this quarter alone we're down and we have to look at the volume. We're down 4.3% in residential housing. But the reasons for it are so complex. We need more workers.
Yeah.
We don't have enough workers. We need more investment. And even though that really cuts to the heart of some of the problems we had in the past, we still need more private investors and we still need to incentivize them. Less bureaucracy. There's a huge amount of paperwork involved, VAT, tax incentives, public-private partnership options. If you look at the amount of apartments that we built in the last year, we're something like 70% away from the amount of apartments that we need by the end of this year.
The apartments are 40% down on the 2023 peak.
Yeah.
40%. It's a big number.
And if you put that forward to where the promises are in terms of the number of apartments, we're just going to be nowhere near it. So there is a need for them to sit down and rewrite. I mean, you made a great point, John, rewrite the story. In the civil service politician world, if you write something down, people believe it's true. I mean, in the business world, as you well know, Bobby, everything is dynamic. You don't have a strategy that sits in a drawer. You constantly write it depending on what's going on around you. We seem to have, there's the strategy for the housing problem and we're not going to look at it again. And there's so many different bits of it broken. You have to, put together a special task force and say, OK, how do we fix this? How do we ensure? Because clearly we're not going to do what it says on paper at the moment.
Hey, this is going to be difficult for the government, John, isn't it?
Well, I think so. There's a bit I wanted to point out in Colin Gleeson's report on these numbers, where he brings out a report by estate agents JLL, which says that even though there's a slump now, there's expected to be a rebound in 2026 and 2027 on the back of a surge in apartment construction starts that happened last year when developers accelerated their projects to capitalize on waiver of levies. And I think, again, this goes back to what Cliff is talking about, but the inconsistency of policy. So there was everybody was sitting on their hands. The builders were sitting on their hands waiting for this waiver levy, which they had been telegraphed was coming. So they didn't do starts. And we're seeing the consequences of that now, of the builders not doing things because they were expecting better conditions in the future. And now then they got them. So there'll be a surge next year and the year after. But it's just a matter of like having that policy consistency where everybody knows on a 5 to 10 year horizon what the economic circumstances are going to be like for them. What are the taxes? What is the regulations going to be? What kind of levies? What are the costs of building, etc.? And without that foreknowledge, you'll have the hesitation in the private sector as much as in the public sector.
Yeah. It's a very busy weekend in Dublin. The weather is fantastic. We had the Lions last night. Zach Byrne is out in the Phoenix Park. There's a real buoyancy around the place, but the Indo tells us that when the city is neglected, you get decline. And this is around the announcement of a closure of River Island. The latest blow for area traders feel is in slow but steady decline. What are your thoughts on this, Nora? You know, retail is still struggling, even though there are a lot of people in town.
Yeah, and Henry Street was my, you know, my place to go because I grew up in the Phoenix Park. So the number 10, number 14 bus took us straight to O'Connell Street. So I didn't even know Grafton Street existed quite late in my life. So Henry Street was always a little bit more rough and ready, let's say, than Grafton Street. It was just a place where you could go to Moore Street Market, you could go in and out of shops that were, you know, Hector Gray's. I mean, you know, some parts of this article are talking about, you know, so low-end shops and things, but they were always there. River Island has many, many outlets in Dublin. It has a huge one in Dundrum. It has one here, not too far from these offices. So that's part of their strategy in terms
consolidation.
Of... Yes, if you order something from River Island now, it'll arrive in 48 hours. So there are lots of people who don't live in Dublin. There are lots of people who do live in Dublin and would prefer to order online. So the fact that they still have high street presence is fantastic. And I saw that Dublin Town, that consortium that, you know, Mr. Guiney represents, and they said that there was already interest, active interest in somebody taking that over. The bigger picture that emerges from that article is really issues around safety. And, you know, the retail owners and the butcher from Moore Street, very famous man.
FX Buckley?
No. He's been there for, they've been there for a very long time. He's fifth generation, Stephen Troy. So he talks about, you know, he's been there for five generations and he's talking about, you know, drugs being sold openly, about issues around safety, about, you know, theft within the stores, not just theft, but sometimes headbutting and violence that goes along with the thefts, and they don't have sufficient patrols. The place isn't kept clean.
He also said, I think, which is a real killer point, is that there seems to be zero consequences around shoplifting.
Yeah, he said that. Yeah.
So people will continue to do it.
Yeah.
I don't know. It saddens me. I worked in town for 35 years, and I see it as a very different place to what it used to be. The nature of how people shop has changed.
Yeah.
And I just feel that the city hasn't really changed with it. I don't know what you think, John.
Well, I was saying to Nora there before we came on air that I've always felt that Dublin had that bit of edginess, you know, that like this sense that maybe it's not quite unsafe, but just like a little grimy, a little derelict, you know. So I don't really see it as a whole lot different from one year to the next. I'm probably a bit of an outlier there, and I don't mean to minimize the struggles that retailers are going through and the challenges that they have to deal with every day. I dip in and out of town. I don't have to spend 8 hours a day there. So I'm probably not giving you an accurate representation of everything that happens in the city. But if you'd asked me the same question in 2005, I would have said, yeah, I see drug addicts. I see drug dealing. I see shoplifting.
Empty houses,
all that kind of stuff kind of has always been a feature, and it's almost a chronic structural feature of urban life in Dublin. And something someone said to me years and years ago that has stuck with me, this was a sociologist, and he said, oh, the difference between Irish people and Americans is we're anti-urban. We actually don't like cities. That's why Dublin always feels like it's on the verge of chaos. We actually don't like cities. You know?
I think the article talks, though, what I loved about the excitement of going into town. Now, as a woman, I just know the excitement of going into town and, you know, to go shopping, to meet your friends, to have a coffee. Mm. My mother went in almost every day of her life. But if ever there was an argument for a mayor of Dublin, the state of the inner city is definitely one where you'd say one cohesive voice. Look how many voices commented in that article. All these people who have a bit of responsibility for a bit of the centre, you know.
I don't know. I'm kind of saddened by it, but it is a changing. It's a changing scene, and I just think, you know, things like security, things like safety, they have to be addressed. Cleanliness, all that. It needs to be a pleasant place to come into.
Yeah, exactly.
But as a basic.
Yeah.
And then you'll do your shopping, and then you'll do your entertaining or whatever else it is.
Yeah.
Anyway, we hope it resolves itself. Let's look at a business story, John. McDonald's Irish franchise reporting 17% jump in profits. 42 million at McDonald's Irish arm as overheads and tech costs fell. It's in a remarkable business. It's a remarkable enterprise. It's a franchise. It's probably the world's best franchise, but it's a really successful franchise for the franchisees. You know, to a man and a woman, they're successful. And there are 95 franchise restaurants here in Ireland, and they all seem to be doing well.
Right, and there's also going to be an expansion, Bobby. So things are going well enough for McDonald's that they're looking at putting 40 million euros in over the next 4 years as part of an expansion plan. They already employ nearly 10,000 people. And as John Mulligan in the Irish Independent points out, and as you're saying there, several very successful franchisees who are making you know, millions out of this brand. And so it's really worked. It's really worked for them, and it's worked for the company. But there are some challenges on the horizon. You know, their rivals like Wendy's and Popeyes and Taco Bell have seen how well McDonald's is doing in Ireland, and they're all coming next as well. And it's interesting how they're deciding to do it. And they're not pursuing the same kind of franchise model that McDonald's is doing, but instead they're teaming up with petrol stations. So I believe it's Wendy's has teamed up with Carboil, and Taco Bell has partnered with Applegreen sort of spread their brand through the petrol stations, which is kind of an interesting way of going about it. Now, not quite as much, you know, McDonald's really flies the flag on the high street, and that's their strategy, and that's where they've pledged to put more money, you know, open up more places. There's been some planning pushback in some of those, you know, to reach back to Cliff's article there. But overall, like a big success story in terms of retail, and one that is maybe a welcome contrast to some of the negative stuff that we're hearing in other areas.
I'll just say that, well, firstly, we're just talking about high streets, and there's McDonald's bucking the trend. Mm. But if you look behind that story, in the one that Ian Curran writes, it's really the assets that are going up, and they have more. So in fact, they had a small drop in their revenues. And in the US, they had the biggest drop that they've had since pre-COVID.
That's so, one of the alarm bells that John is alluding to.
And
there.
I just want, like, they can construct, obviously. Yeah. Maybe they could advise the government.
But just
because that's only happened in a year.
Just to close it out on a positive note, most of those franchisees who were all very successful all started in McDonald's at the very bottom and worked their way up.
Yeah.
That's the model.
Mm.
So it's a wonderful
model
of success that if you start. Yeah. John, the Nordic Group mulling higher offer for Dalata as it buys more shares. Is this business about to be sold?
I think so. I mean, Dalata themselves back in March initiated their own strategic review, which is code for we're for sale. This bid probably came in a little earlier than they were hoping and probably came in a lot lower than they were looking for. So there'll be a bit of a dance, I think, over the summer as this Nordic consortium either ups their stake or other bidders come in and try to gazump them. But really, for me, this is less about the business, which is actually quite a successful business. Like, Dalata's not under pressure that they had to sell. And I'm not actually sure that management wants to give up control. But shareholders, I think there's been a certain amount of agitation for any company that's listed on the Irish stock market about the persistent discount of Irish listed shares versus peers in other markets. And that has to do with low levels of liquidity and investor interests. Like, the stock market here is really, really struggling. So I see this as a stock market story, more than a company story. And you've seen loads of these stock market companies are getting picked off by private buyers over the years. You've also seen the big flagship companies like Flutter and CRH and Smurfit Kappa move their listings to New York. Yeah. And it's a trend that doesn't show any signs of slowing down. Now, I know there's an Irish equity market forum that is looking for changes in government policy and in taxation and in allowing anchor funds and tax advantage stock market investment funds for retail investors. But that stuff probably isn't going to arrive at the earliest in this year's budget. And it may be a little too late for our dwindling stock market because Dalata is potentially going to be taken out as well.
Okay, very interesting. Dodgy boxes asking for a friend, ethical dilemma, but savings are incredible. Also, there's a Q&A in the Irish Times about Android boxes. They're legit, so what's all the big deal? Nora Casey, I'd never be as bold to suggest on air that you could be an owner of a dodgy box, but I'm sure you know some people who do.
I'm definitely not an owner of a dodgy box. When Richard worked for the BBC, he said there were only two reasons for being sacked. One would be not to have a television licence, and the other would involve some extramarital relations in the office. So, but I am intrigued by dodgy boxes because, firstly, I didn't know what they were, and now I know they're a stick, and I know the box itself is not illegal. An Android box is perfectly legal. It's the apps that you download that cause the problem. But Connor talks to, I don't know what his name is, but it's a fake name. Mm. And he describes the ethical dilemma of the dodgy box. So There's no doubt Sky and all of the streaming platforms, I subscribe to so many of them, and there's a huge amount going out the door every single month. So he's worked out that he spent 300 through a very reputable source, he says, somebody he's known for a long time. And he got the stick and he put it in. And from then onwards, it costs him 150 a year. I'm not doing an ad, by the way. But this is the ethical dilemma for him in obviously a cash-strapped household. He pays 150 a year to watch all of the football and everything that he wants to watch.
Yeah.
He thought it would be terrible service and that the streaming would be off, but it isn't. It's all much better now. Better still, he can take the stick on holiday with him and stick it into the television when he's abroad and he can watch the same stuff. And and he worked out that he was at that time paying $250 a month,
yeah,
versus $150 a year. Now I know that Sky are doing a wag at the Christie on, you know, going around trying to look at WhatsApp messages and see if we can find out who's got the dodgy box. But I heard a great interview during the week where the guards were kind of saying, "Well, you know, we've no interest
in
hauling some private individual over watching football matches."
John Allen is very quiet. He must have a dodgy box. The way
Bobby, I tell
he
you,
hasn't said a word.
No, I'm such a rule follower, Bobby. Like I would never do it. I would never do it. So I have a few subscriptions. Like I'm not really. I would never spend anything like $250 a month, but certain sports things I like. You know, I watch the cycling in the summer, so I download, you know, it's like the TNT app, and then I have DAZN, which is for my son who watches American football. So I have a few of these, and then every now and then, you know, I'll review all my subscriptions and I'll get rid of a few like that. Like that's basically my ways.
You're one of the smart ones that actually does
I
that. I wish I could do more of that. Finally, can we talk about starting your meal without waiting for others? It's not rude. A study finds. And you know what? When you think about it, if somebody served food and it's piping hot and it's going cold, they really should start eating, should they not?
Oh, I'm just doing this from now on, Bobby. I'm just going to dig into my meal. There's
something, if you're with your family, there's something lovely about everybody starting to eat at the same time. There's nothing worse than somebody with their arms folded, I've finished my dinner and you're just getting yours, you know. But the way I tend to eat, and lots of people do now, is bring it as it's ready and, you know, they're sharing and, you know, it's not necessarily a plate of food in front of you.
Yeah,
or something,
so that
you know?
Everybody tucks into what's produced.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's much more social.
I have type 1 diabetes, so if I take insulin and my food comes, I have to eat it within a certain period of time. That's my excuse.
That's a fair enough excuse, Nora. John Isle and Nora Casey, thank you for your great review of the Business Stories. Enjoy your weekend.
Down to Business with Bobby Kerr.
Brought to you by Bank of Ireland.
Saturday morning at 11 on News Talk.